Without further ado, I'm going to hand over to one of our Year 12 Geography students who's going to introduce tonight's speaker, Grace Osborne. Where's Grace?
Danny Dorling is the Harvard Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford University. He grew up in Oxford and went to the University of Newcastle to study maths, geography and statistics before researching the visualisation of spatial social structure for his PhD. He has also worked in Bristol, Leeds, Sheffield and New Zealand. With a group of colleagues, he helped to create the World Mapper website, which shows who is the most and least in the world. Many of his published papers, commentaries and reports are freely available online. His work concerns issues of housing, health, education, employment and poverty. His recent books include Population 10 Billion, published in 2013. It's a pleasure to welcome Professor Dorling to the Thomas Hardy School for tonight's community lecture.
Thank you very much for that. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
That's good. I've got too many slides, so I'm going to click through them, but I'm not going to address them all because it can get a bit boring if I go into too much detail. I was thinking about telling you an anecdote about Tim, but I won't unless you ask a question later. But I didn't know him, I think, 20 years ago, which is one of the reasons for being here. It's very kind of you to invite me. The map you're still looking at behind is a map of the world. It's a strange map of the world. It's a map which has been stretched so that everybody in the world gets the same amount of space. And if you look carefully, you'll see that we are pushed off to the edge. The UK only has about 1%, less than 1% of the world's population now. We only have 0.5% of the world's children. So we are getting smaller relatively very quickly. Although we do have people coming in, which does help because we haven't produced enough children to reproduce ourselves now for about 30 years, like the rest of Europe, like the United States. What you're seeing behind in terms of a picture of the planet is a good news story. It's a planet which, although the population is still going up and appears to be going up quite quickly, the rate of acceleration is actually slowing. So fertility rates in the world are coming down dramatically. Peak baby in the world was 1990. Haven't had as many babies again in the world as we had in 1990. We're at peak 25-year-old now. Over half the world is below fertility replacement level. And it is possible, and I think probable, that within the lifetimes of some of the students at this school, we will actually hit a peak of world population and it will begin to fall. That's a very good news story if you worry about how many people there are on the planet. There are lots of reasons for optimism, but I'm going to worry about reasons for pessimism today. And the reasons for pessimism is because of where we happen to be. The United Kingdom is a very strange country amongst the richest 25 countries on the planet. I'll just try to show you a way of bolstering why you should listen to me for half an hour, but I'm sure, you know, after the next half an hour you may well disagree with me. These are the covers of some of the books I've done recently. So I've done a book on housing, what's happening to house prices in the country and what's going to happen, how are youngsters going to get themselves housed. I've done a book, I can't remember the one, health. I've done a book with a very boring cover about the 1%. I'll show you in a minute the exciting cover that I rejected. Anyway, about the 1% and what they claim. I look at injustice. I look at Europe. We've done an atlas of Europe because we don't think people in Britain know what it is they're choosing or about to choose to leave or not to leave. And it actually taught me quite a lot. I'm a geographer, I should know about Europe, but we could do a little quiz about who knows which countries are actually in the EU at the moment. It's hopefully over the next 18 months we're going to become very educated about this. I'm hoping that the debate about Europe is all going to be about, did you know about this country, and this country. I suspect it might not be about that, but we'll see. Population 10 billion, world population prospects is something else with colleagues I work on. Man for Britain, what's happened since 2008, the debt and the deficit, because these things are affecting us greatly at the moment. And then I do things about London, about equality, and that's the cover. That's the cover which I rejected in February of this year for the second edition of this book, which came out in September, 1 week after that particular newspaper headline. I still, because I'm academic, I think it was the right thing to do to reject the cover, but if I had accepted that cover, that could have sold so well I could have been. And of course the picture is taken of a street in my hometown of Oxford, and you'll know the subtext of this. If you grew up in Oxford, then you have a particular attitude to the university, which is different from if you go to the university. If you then go and take a job in university, having grown up in Oxford, you are conflicted about where you are and how you fit in. This country, as I'll show you probably to far too great an extent in the next few slides, has incredible rates of inequality in it now. These are rates of inequality not just in how much money people earn compared to other people, or in terms of the wealth that some people have compared to other people, but also in the amount of money that's spent on the education of some groups as opposed to other groups, or in terms of the health differences in different parts of the country, and for people growing up in different social classes. Our regional health divides are the widest regional health divides in Europe, between the northeast and actually quite near to here. You're very lucky, you are in one of the healthiest parts of the country. Part of the reason is that quite a lot of you have migrated to be here. You are healthy elderly migrants, you've actually arrived in the place. Part of the reason why the areas of the country with poor health have such poor health, think of Glasgow, is that Glasgow has lost half its population in the last 40 years. The regional divides in health in this country are wider than any other country in Europe. The next widest divides are in Germany, and that's between the old Eastern Länder and the West. So we've actually managed somehow to end up with a country that's more divided than a country which had an iron curtain drawn around it. This is a summary statistic for inequality over time. It is the take of the best of 1% since around 1920 to a few years ago. The top line is the take before tax, and the bottom line is the take after tax. I'm a child, I was born in the 60s, I'm a child of the 1970s. The 1970s was the most equal we've ever been. In the 1970s, the best off 1% took 6% of all income, that's six times the average income, just four times after tax. The wage differentials between people in the early 1970s were the lowest they'd ever been. We had a functioning labour market, which means that you could actually leave your job because you didn't like your job and go and get another job. That's a good market, that's how markets are supposed to work. Since the late 1970s, we haven't had a functioning labour market. We have had structural unemployment, particularly for the young, at a fairly high rate. The decrease there in inequality is a decrease that's been pretty steady all the way from the 1920s and 30s through to the 1970s. The early 1920s were a time of Downton Abbey, so a few people here, the 1%, had 20% of all income, and many people had very little, or people had servants and so on. That reduced, if you want we can talk about it later, about why it reduced, but it reduced everywhere, in every rich country in the world. Half the reduction happened before the Second World War, which is worth knowing. It wasn't just about the Second World War. Half of it had occurred by 1939. We got to a level of very low inequality by the 70s, and then we went one way. Other countries didn't. And I'm a geographer, so I'm interested in what happened in other countries. You're told that this has happened everywhere. It's inevitable. You have to accept it. Top talent's being rewarded. If you can complain about it, your country will go to the dogs and it won't work. That's a common message. I think a lot of people who say that message actually believe that message. I don't think people aren't Machiavellian. But I also think they don't know it's not true, because they simply haven't seen the statistics that say it isn't true. This picture was taken by a friend of mine who's German. He quite liked the image. It's a UKIP picture. I see lots of good news, so I won't try and give you the list that's behind me, because I want to not keep turning round and not looking at you. But I am an optimistic person, I think I am. UKIP is what many of European countries have. Most European countries have a mildly right-wing anti-immigration party. I partly see the rise of UKIP as being the country becoming more European. Not many people do, but it's one way of looking at it. I see what's recently happened in the Labour Party as the Labour Party moving towards becoming a normal European mass left-wing party. It's a very tiny move to the left on the European political scale. We've had huge improvements in the way that we treat other people in this country. The intolerance of racism has risen and risen. We still have racism, but nothing like we had in the 70s. I happen to like the 70s, my favourite decade. You could get a job, you could get a house, you could start a family, all those kind of things that you can't do now unless you're very well off at a young age. But we were more intolerant, we were more racist, we were more homophobic. We did lots of things which now we look back and may be a bit ashamed about. If you want one example about how fast things can change, we used to cane people in schools. When I was at school, we got caned. Then we banned it in state schools, and a bit later on, you could pay for it still, but we banned it in independent schools. So this is why I'm an optimist. There are so many things you can see that have changed so fast that were tolerated and now are seen as completely intolerable. I think it is wrong when I show you some things that look a bit depressing to think, oh, the future's, nothing's going to happen, it won't get better. Because usually things do get better. Things are getting worse. In London at the moment, and I've lived half my life in the north, so I could go through things going wrong in the north of England, the further the shops in Sheffield when I left it 2 years ago and being boarded up, that's kind of easy. What's harder is actually looking at what's going wrong in the prosperous parts of the country. In London, private landlords are buying 1% of property every year and have been doing for at least the last 15 years. The whole of London is going at the current rate to end up being largely private rented. There are 250,000 children in London now who live in poverty, that's in poor houses, we know they're poor because we know the amount of benefits they get, who have a private landlord. More than actually are in council housing or housing association. Why is this a problem? Well, apart from the fact their parents have to pay much higher rent if they've got a private landlord, they're being moved on average every couple of years, slightly more than every 2 years. And when you're a child, being moved and having to move school every 2 years is not good. It's also not good for the boroughs of London who are trying to educate these children, who have done quite well until recently, but are suddenly going to have to cope with an itinerant population. Since 2008, in England, the number of families with children who are renting privately has shot up from a very temporary 8% to about a quarter of all children in England are now in a house that's got a private landlord and a two-month tenancy. It happened very quickly, and it happened because of the nature of the crash. What occurred was that banks and building societies were unable to lend in 2009 and 10 because they couldn't borrow. People still had to move house, so people like me move house, and we rent. There's too many people trying to rent, so the rents go up. Landlords get more money because the rents go up. What do they do? They go and buy another house. House prices go up because landlords are buying houses. The rents go up because people can't afford to buy because the house prices have gone up. Landlords buy more and more. It's an incredible spiral. This is London, this is Oxford, this is Brighton, it's probably touching Bournemouth. I suspect it's not quite in here yet, but you can tell me better. And it's creating this kind of a society, because now most landlords don't do that well. Most landlords only have one or two properties. They're amateurs. There'll be people among you who are landlords, but most of you will be amateur landlords. But from the point of view of tenants, most tenants have professional landlords who own 40 or 200 or 300 properties. And they're watching this set of people. And it's not just landlords, it is financiers and other people enriching themselves while other people are finding that their money's going on housing costs in a way that didn't happen for their parents' generation. And this is getting youngsters angry. At the extreme, if you take the Sunday Times Rich List, which is the 1,000 richest people in the country, they doubled their wealth since 2008. Well, everybody else is getting less. So you're seeing incredible changes in inequality in recent years. What you end up being told is the thing that Tawney, who was a philosopher in the 1930s and a lecturer in politics, what Tawney called the tadpole philosophy. The tadpole philosophy, and we've forgotten about it because it's been such a long time since the 1930s, is that we would get all the sixth formers in the audience and we get you all to sit up here. And then we tell you, okay, you're doing your A-levels now. But if you work hard, go to university, get a degree, get a good job, get promoted, do better than all the other students, then you too can climb up the rock and you can end up owning 50 houses and being a landlord or getting £1 million job in a bank. The problem with the tadpole philosophy, the reason it was called the tadpole philosophy, if you just think about tadpoles in the pond and the frog sitting on the rock, clearly not all the tadpoles can fit onto the rock. This is the problem. But we try to tell people to have aspiration and not imagination. Right, have aspiration, try to get yourself up there. Don't, whatever you do, do the maths and suddenly work out how many people could be in the best off 1%. Very easy to work out how many people could be in the 1%. But the reason it matters is that since 2008, the only group who have seen an increase in their income have been the best off 1%. So what do? You tell everybody try as hard as you can to be in that group? But this is our problem. It's a very recent problem. It's only been since 2008. The best off 1% are individuals with a household income of about 160,000. If there's two of you, about £200,000 a year. Get yourself just in that group and you're in the group who are going up. It no longer includes doctors. About 200 general practitioners who also own dispensing pharmacies. We just about get here. But in general, doctors aren't in the 1% anymore. Head teachers are not in the 1% anymore. They used to be. A 1% has always been 1%. But in the 1970s, it had a wider range of people and was also spread around the country. Now the 1% is almost all finance, management, and a few, you know, very well-off property owners. It's not the same broad group in society that it used to be. This is the most complicated graph, actually, I'm lying. There's one that's even worse than this, I warn you. But this is a fairly complicated one. This is data from the British Social Attitude Survey. So 1983 to 2012. And on the side, I do apologise for ridiculous size font, age 18 at the top, age 90 at the bottom. The reds are people by year and age who were renting. So the important thing is you've got a green stripe there. Back in the 80s, as soon as you got to about age 60, you had a majority of the population renting. They were renting because they're the residuals from the old private renting of the past and council housing tenants. That group disappeared with age. That's renting in old age. That green is homeowner democracy, which rose dramatically in the 80s and 90s. And what you're seeing in the most recent years, just the beginning of it, is a new renting-only generation coming in. So the data is showing this happening. What you end up telling people who are in their 30s or 40s is that they need to, they need to try to get into that green group. They need to somehow get a gift from a grandparent or a parent to allow them to get a deposit on a tiny flat, a one-bed flat in Hackney, so they can become homeowners. And the precarity of it's enormous. I mean, only a small portion of people can actually do this. And the worst thing about it, even though interest rates are at an historic low, If you're talking £500,000 for a one-bed flat in some of these places, you know, I don't know, some grandparents give you £100,000, somebody else does this, and you've mortgaged yourself to the absolute hilt. You buy this one-bed flat at £500,000, not quite knowing whether you were the fool who bought it just before the prices go down. And if they go down, you could be left with £200,000 negative equity. I mean, it's... And what's fascinating, I've got to... There's two hats here. One is I live here, I've got kids and I care about people, and this upsets me then. The other hat is, isn't this a really exciting social experiment? to see what's going on. What will happen? What would a set of upper middle class, you know, young 40-year-olds do if they found themselves in that situation and they'd done everything right? And the weirdness of politics since 2008 is I get assistant editors in the Daily Telegraph asking me to write about this because it's their life. Even though, as you've already worked out, hopefully my politics is somewhat away from the Daily Telegraph. Things are going on in this country which are very, very strange. And the worry is you have this one-off. I don't think we will have one home-owning generation. I'm optimistic. I would like to see us... I'm not a complete fan of Europe, but I'm a geographer. You do have to go and look at other countries to see that there are other ways of doing. I would like us to have a bigger private rented sector. There are good reasons to have it. I don't see why we can't regulate it like they do in New York or in Berlin or in fact in most of the rest of the developed world. So that we don't have the lowest housing conditions in Western Europe, so that we don't have the highest prices. Private landlords are not taking that rent and spending it on making these the most beautiful properties of the world. They're just taking that rent. We could have, in 10, 20 or 30 years' time, a housing system like the Netherlands has now. One in which you actually have a choice between whether you want to rent or going to buy, or like Germany. But where you know, whatever you do, you're not going to make a fortune out of it. Because you cannot make a fortune out of doing nothing. You really can't. If you have made a fortune out of doing nothing, somebody else is going to pay for it. Right? There isn't a magic money tree when it comes to housing. But we have a politics that means that any politician who promises or tries hard to push the house prices up as high as possible will be rewarded for keeping the magic money tree myth going. Well, at the same time, the very same politicians talk about there isn't no magic money tree. Well, they're actually getting more votes by, you know, trying to keep one going for as long as possible. Let's get off that graph. So this is the problem. We are telling young people that we've created a much more competitive environment, the gaps between rich and poor are getting wider, and so what you've got to do is work harder, because you don't want to be end up at the bottom of the society in the future, because the bottom's going to be tougher. And it just can't work in aggregate for them. This is the relative size of the student debt bubble in the United States. It is out of control. Very few rich countries have student loans. We do now. We've only had big loans since 2010. The government already accepts that half of them are not going to be repaid. Korea has them, Australia has them, New Zealand has little ones. Most of Europe has hardly any tuition fees. Germany, none. Greece, none. They're tiny. We didn't used to have them. But what we've done is we've individualised education. We've said, your education, at the moment your university education, but I could easily see it's coming to the sixth form here. Then why not charge people a loan to come to the sixth form? Then you could hire a few more teachers and they could repay the loan for the fact they come. Once you've got it in, you can expand it. We've told people that what a university degree is about is improving your own personal financial position so that in future you'll be better off. So you ought to pay for that education because it's going to make you better off. Now, apart from the fact that simply can't work because there are not that many jobs that are that highly paid, it creates a very nasty ethos about what education is about. It encourages you to go into a few occupations that are going to make money and away from things that don't make money, but are more useful. for people to be doing. It steers people in a particular direction, and also means that the majority of those who are steered in that direction, say into particular kind of finance, are going to fail because there's so many of them trying to compete to get there. But in the short term, it means that my sector, the university sector, has seen an increase in a billion in its spare money. So we've had no redundancies. We've had a lot of precarity. Net, we haven't had redundancies. But it just doesn't work long term. I'll give you another example why it can't work long term, or possibly can't work long term. 50% of all young women in England go to university. Half of all young women now. So it's not an elitist thing to talk about going to university. Only 36% of men go to university. 50% of women. For the student loan system to work, we're going to have the most incredible revolution in salaries and wages, where suddenly the jobs that women are more likely to do, including women graduates, are going to get paid a lot more so they can pay the loans back. And men are going to have to be paid a lot less. Now, I think we're going to get some progress with the pay gap between men and women, but we're not going to get that kind of revolution. Remember, this is half of all women in Britain. It doesn't work when you look at numbers. And it matters to me because I've got kids, but it also matters to me because it's the sector that I'm in, and I worry about the long-term funding of it, what's actually going to happen. When you base it on a very, very badly worked out, very temporary solution, which was cooked up in 2010 in the aftermath of a financial crash when we didn't think we had enough money, but didn't want to make cuts. Housing. This graph comes from the work of Becky Tunstall, who's Professor of Housing at the University of York. She's looked at every census since 1911 through to 2011, and about how many rooms the best off 10th of people have in the country compared to the least well-housed 10th. So you've taken the extreme groups, and we'll just look at the top line in this graph, which is that 10 versus 10. In 1911, tiny red dot, the best off 10th of people in Britain had 4 times more rooms per person than the worst off 10th. That means, in 1911, the worst off 10th were sleeping 4 to a room, the best off 10th 1 to a room. So that's how you get that 4 to 1 ratio. Remember, 1911 was back to the time of people having servants, people having big houses. The inequality increased in 1921 slightly, and then it fell and fell and fell. We built nice 1937s, quite big. We saw wage inequality fall. We built council houses to Parker Morris standards and actually started giving them out according to need. So you put people in houses the size of their families. We built maisonettes. And you only got in the maisonette if you had 2 kids and you needed the space in the maisonette. All these kind of things happened. To get you to the heady socialist heights of the 1970s, when the inequality was 3 to 1. Yeah, so it wasn't that equal. The best off 10th had 3 times more rooms per person than the worst off 10th. And then the most remarkable thing happens to 2001 and 2011. This huge increase in inequality and distribution of housing. Three things occurred at least. One was really, really good news, which was ageing. We have a housing stock that's pretty well tuned for us to live till about 73 years old and then die and give up the family house that we were in. We don't have a housing stock that's very well tuned for us to live into our 90s, which is what women, certainly down here, are doing, men about 89. So ageing is one problem, but ageing without having housing nearby that you can move to when you decide that house is too big for you. The other thing that happened, which is just as important, is that the income and wealth gaps between people grew. So that people were not able, in the bottom half of society, to have much choice about how they were housed. They find themselves more and more overcrowded into whatever they can get. While people in the top of society, take people near the 1%, somebody being paid £100,000 a year in London, could get themselves an ex-council maisonette and live in it on their own. Now, they won't feel very well off. This is an ex-council maisonette. It was a maisonette that used to house a family. And if you look across London, you can see how, well, we have more and more empty rooms in the middle of London, despite the prices going up. We have potentially 30 million empty bedrooms in the country. But we ought to have enough bedrooms that every family can have a spare one. So I'm not saying you can't have it, but we are using the rooms and the space more and more inefficiently. At the same time, we haven't built. You do need to build if your population's going up. Our population's going up. Politicians always tell you they want to build houses. They never tell you the reason why they want to build houses, which is immigration, because it wouldn't work politically. But you do need to build houses if you've got your population going up. We haven't been doing that. Another reason for the crowding is, of course, where people come is into London and they're getting more and more crowded. It's a terrible mess. House price rises at the moment in the southeast about 15% a year. They're accelerating. They accelerated with an election that went in a way that wasn't predicted. It's not looking safe. I won't say any more about housing because I go on about it too much, but it's a worry. It should be a worry. It gets to a point when it isn't safe for people who think their home is worth something if part of that value is based on sentiment. And then the sentiment goes one day. Just some pictures about the very best off in society. Because one thing I think is a misconception is to think there's an us and them. And them, the best off 1% or the super rich, are all kind of together huddled on a yacht making some kind of plan. There is more inequality within the 1% than there is in the other 99%. And it's felt. Just below the best off 1%, if you ask people about their incomes, a proportion will tell you they're pretty well off. It's people like me. People know they're pretty well off. When you get into the 1%, this is £160,000-£200,000 incomes, which are London, you find very few people who tell you they're well off, because they're suddenly in a social circuit where they're working for people much better off than them, and they can't afford housing. Three-bed house in Fulham is £800,000, so why do they think they're well off when they can't get a mortgage? And they feel obliged to pay school fees, which have gone up dramatically, whereas it's a choice if you're in my bracket, it's an obligation if you're in the 1%. The middle of the 1% is on £300,000. But this lot, this is the super rich. The super rich, 1,000 families, what you're seeing here is London. 500 of those families live in London. But those 10 families alone are taking over a quarter of the wealth of that 500. So you can be in the Sunday Times rich list and feel squeezed between people who are true billionaires. You know, you've only got 20, 30 million. It's not very much. Because you're almost all here, it isn't a group. There isn't a solid group of people, even at the very top. The bottom of the 1% are often doing kind of service jobs for people like this. So you can be paid £200,000 as a financier looking after the private family income of a couple of very rich families. But you've got to wear the suit, you've got to fly around the world, you've got to go to investor conferences, you've got to try to make their money grow by 10% every year. And if you don't make their money grow by 10% every year, you'll get sacked. And you're in the 1%. This is not a good system when even people who are doing very well are worrying about precarious. And this is despite that doubling. I mean, the doubling is stupendous. We're getting incredible statistics at the moment worldwide. Like, I'll give you three, just three statistics to the kind of things I look out for. One statistic from way back in the late 1960s, when world population was increasing at a very high rate, about 2% a year. A mathematician worked out then that if it carried on increasing at that rate, within 300 years, the entire planet would be a seething mass of bodies with everybody touching each other. That's what we were, a pretty horrible description. What the mathematician was really saying was the late 1960s and early 1970s were a peak growth period. It was a strange time and it wasn't going to carry on. And the mathematician was right. A few years ago, in Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster, we saw life expectancy rises for a few years of more than a year in a year. So for women, they went up from 92 to 93 and a half. For men, they went up from 88 to, you know, 90 in 1 year. When life expectancy goes up by more than a year in Kensington and Chelsea, either Kensington and Chelsea is going to become Mount Olympus, it'll carry on rising like that and people will never die, or something very strange has been happening to Kensington and Chelsea very recently and it will not continue. Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster together are worth more than the whole of Denmark, apparently. My favourite stat on this is there was a point in the late 80s where the Imperial Gardens in Tokyo, which was a large area in the middle of Tokyo, was valued at being worth more than the whole of California, just before house prices halved in Tokyo, the world's biggest crash. World statistics on this lot, the richest 1% in the world saw their ownership of wealth in the world rise by 7 percentage points about 12 months ago. So it's over 50%. If that were to continue, if you get a 7 percentage point increase in the take of the very best of for another 7 years, that's 49 percentage points, they own everything. Now what that should tell you, you can get slightly worried that the super rich are going to own everything very soon, or you can say, we're living in a very strange time, it is very weird, it is not sustainable, and we should worry about what's going to happen, but we shouldn't despair, because it's just a ridiculous change that's happened. These six countries were chosen by somebody else. I haven't cherry-picked them. I look at all the richest 25. It's the take of the 1%. Piketty was an obscure economist from France when I first found his graphs. Now he's a very well-known one. All these countries become more equal, and then they go in different directions. The United States has become the most unequal. But if you look at the dashed line, that's us. And we've done this amazing thing in Europe. We were the second most equal large country to Sweden in the 70s. And we've hopped over country after country after country to become the most unequal country in Europe. The Netherlands down there, the best off 1% are taking half as much than they take here. That's about an entire National Health Service a year. This is about the money you're talking about. 15% is being taken in the UK. One way of thinking about this, think about 100 children. One child gets £15 pocket money a day. All the other children get 85p a day. That's what the inequality in income is. Of course, they don't actually get that. Half the children get no pocket money. 6.7% of the Netherlands. It is remarkably different. What you get in the Netherlands is the boss of Royal Dutch Shell saying, if you paid me twice as much, I wouldn't work any harder. If you paid me half as much, I'd work just as hard. Even in the States, you get Warren Buffett saying that it's bad that my secretary pays a higher tax rate than I do. We don't have anybody in Britain. As far as I can tell, I haven't managed to find a single quote of that kind from anybody in Britain. We are a very strange country at the moment, going through very strange times at the moment. And I think it's coincidence and circumstance as well as anything else. We have over 2,200 bankers who have paid over €1 million a year. 2,200. The next highest in Europe is Germany, where they have 197. Very odd. And why do they need over €1 million a year? Because they want to have a house in Kensington, Chelsea or Westminster. Right? And this is the league table for the best of 25 countries in the world with at least 2 million people. Japan is the most equal. That's the ratio of the best of 10th to worst of 10th. Then predictably Finland, Norway, Sweden, Germany. Pretty equal country. part of the reason why it's so productive. Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, then Switzerland. The 1% in Switzerland take half as much as 1% here. Bankers are paid half as much in Switzerland where they have bankers and they're paid here. Going up, France, the Netherlands, which is the middle country by this measure, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, and then Israel. Israel's a very unequal country. There are problems and difficulties in Israel, I won't say any more than that. But if we go up, we have a ratio of inequality in our income fraction above Israel's. We are a divided country. We're used to it. We're used to this country. We slowly became this divided again. But it is odd. Portugal was more unequal than us. These stats are 5 years out of date. Portugal's become more equal because the poor had so little in Portugal they couldn't lose much. The US is more unequal, and because we look at the US so often, we don't realise how strange we are. The US is strange, and I won't say anything about Singapore unless you're interested in Singapore. Singapore's interesting in terms of where we might be trying to get to. And I'm going to ignore all of that and go back to this. This was a cartoon published in the 1930s. I think it was drawn in 1929. It's called The Quality of Sacrifice. It was about austerity, and the idea was that everybody should take a step down. We tried to redraw it recently. It's quite hard. People really annoyingly do not wear headgear to give away their social class. And you have to put women in as well now, it's much harder. The point that was being made then was that the unemployed man was going to drown if you all stepped down. The difference now, I do have the updated figures. You add two noughts. That's what you do to the salaries. You add two noughts. And the difference has been that the man at the top has actually just stepped up. Actually, they didn't do it in the 1930s. Not deliberately. I do not think this was deliberate. I think it was partly the pound lost 20% of its value. Most people in Britain went, oh, overseas holidays have got more expensive. Right? Nobody actually, there was no, the pound in your pocket's worth just as much. No, nobody said that to you. But the pound lost 20% of its value. If you were the man at the top, and you owned property in three other places, and you had to move around the world, you needed your income to go up by 20% just to stay still. Right? That, it didn't look like me from the point of view of you at the top. A 20% pay rise wasn't any pay rise, because you're an international person. This is a horrible graph I warned you about. And we're getting to the end. I've got about 10 more minutes and I've stopped. Yeah. This is IMF data, right? International Monetary Fund. The IMF are not a radical group. They're not, you know, not a revolutionary set of people producing dodgy statistics. What this data shows, and the thick black line is the UK, is the proportion of GDP that's spent on public services. It's very similar to the proportion of GDP we tax, because you have to tax to pay for public services. You're told often that we are a high tax and spend country. I think the people who tell you that actually believe it to be true. I do not think they're lying. I honestly think we've got to a ridiculous situation where that nobody is telling the people who tell you that what the IMF know. I mean, it may sound ridiculous. You must think, oh, no, they must know that we actually... You know, look at us. We're a low tax and spend country amongst the rich countries of the world. We've always been a low tax and spend country compared to other countries. We did have a naughty little rise, 2003, 4 and 5, there's this increase, which I think was very naughty, because if you take out the cost of that war, it would be flat. And nobody ever blames the government of 2003, 4 and 5 for increasing public spending by paying for a war, which turns out not to have been such a great war as they thought it was. Every country's public spending shoots up in 2008-09 because they had to bail out the banks. That's bail out the bank money. Ireland is unbelievable. You've really got to worry for Ireland and what happened in Ireland. And if you want to say it's good to be down there at the bottom, Islands to worry. Japan is fairly near the bottom. Japan's a really interesting country, because Japan does relatively low tax spend, but in Japan, households have similar amounts of money to begin with. So you don't need to have the kind of welfare spending that you have to have in countries with inequality. At the top, you've got Finland, taxing and spending over half its money. Then you've got France, Denmark, Belgium, Austria, Sweden, Italy, Portugal, Norway, Germany. These countries are not basket cases. The average household income in France is about 4,000 or 5,000 euros more than it is for the median household here, before the cost of housing is even considered, and housing is cheaper in France. The average middle French family is better off than the average family in the UK. But nobody tells you that, because nobody calculates it, because for years we've been telling each other that France is an economic basket case without looking at any numbers. Then we suddenly look and go, oh, they're more productive than us. How can that be? At least we don't do that with Germany anymore. You know, we don't say what a terrible country Germany is economically. And the cuts we are getting and about to get, these are the projected figures that our government gives the IMF, are similar to the ones that Greece has. It just shocks me. So when you're being, in my case, what I call optimistic, we have a huge range of options. We could choose to be, and these options are not weird, wacky options, these are options in the middle of the distribution. We could choose to have European income tax levels. It's not much higher, maybe talking 60%, maybe 58% of your income over £200,000. We could have normal wealth taxation, the kind of wealth taxation they have in America for property. Where in London you'd have a flat council tax that went up and up as your value of your property went up. If you own a £60 million mansion in Westminster, your council tax is £1,300 a year. It's the lowest. Why do you think the richest people in the world are buying property in London? If we needed to, we could raise wealth taxes, particularly from London, to fund for things in London at the same rate they do in America. If we needed to, we could raise income taxes. They wouldn't actually fund that much. You wouldn't get a huge amount from the higher rate. What you'd get is that people stop paying themselves so much. Once you get higher marginal income tax rates, you find that companies will not pay their top bankers as much because they're giving it straight to the Treasury. People still work for large amounts of money. They don't stop working. But the bank will then employ more people because it's got more money. Why are we where we are? I think I've only got 2 or 3 minutes, so I must be fast. It's not our fault. Winning a war tends to make you more unequal, and we've won most wars we've been in. Germany, and particularly Japan, were made very equal by losing wars. In Japan, the Americans took land off the aristocracy and gave it out equally in an experiment. The Americans were very afraid there'd be a revolution in Japan. What they actually created was the world's largest middle class. There are people who argue that inequality is good. There were people, particularly in the late 70s and 80s. We've kind of done the experiment now to see what happens if you're an unequal country, I think. If you're trying to see why different countries went in different directions in the 70s and 80s, I think you can make a case that the arguments against rising inequality here were not working very well. In other countries, they did manage. There are other factors. Racism makes it possible to have the kind of inequalities they have in the USA. The idea of people think it's okay if a section of the population has absolutely no wealth because that section of the population are not white. We may have similar issues about social class that we find uncomfortable or even normal, but you do not find in countries that have different attitudes to people. It's possible, but it's very hard for us to know because we're in the middle of it. When we look at Israel and Singapore, we can see it. When you look at Singapore, it's Chinese and Malay. We know what's going on there. In most of the world, inequality is due to poverty. Most countries have much higher rates of inequality than the rich countries. Equality is something that rich countries gain and also possibly makes them richer because people are more productive when they're actually paid enough to be able to live in a decent way. and the consequences are well known. I'm going to skip over five of these and just end up with something about schools, because I've gone over my time. We've seen that trust reduces in countries that are more unequal. We don't know as much about each other. It makes sense, of course we don't, but when inequality rises, we live in different parts of the town and so on. I'm going to show you why we learn less when we compete more. This is one thing I found recently that shocked me. Exam results become more and more important. Because if you are heading for a very unequal society, you want your children to do really well at school and university. It's possible that we are not learning at the same time. So I'm going to show you maths. And I'm going to show you some international data, and then I'm going to end. We've done the same thing for literacy and the same thing for problem solving, which are tested internationally. These are 15-year-olds. This is the average score in maths on the y-axis. And this is how unequal they are on the x-axis. And in the US and UK, we do pretty badly at maths. In the more equal countries, they do a bit better. But there's quite a lot of randomness. You can see quite a lot of randomness there. And Singapore's always a worry. But can you see, you know, we have incredibly competitive schools. We examine people every year. Why aren't we doing as well at maths? This is age 15. So let's do the same tests for the children, but when they're not children. Exactly the same test, but take it at age 16 to 24. And this shocked me. We only produced this graph about 2 months ago. Everything falls into line. Singapore disappears because they don't actually test young adults. We don't know where Singapore is. Japan and France and Germany, they're really good at maths at age 24. We're abysmal. What's happened? I'll tell you my guess about what's happened. We've tried really, really hard to get people to get an A star at GCSE or an A at GCSE, or at least a C at GCSE. So we put all our effort into teaching people how to get an A or a B or a C, and the same at A level, on that day, which they get. Then if you get a C at GCSE, you can become a policewoman. If you get an A at GCSE, you can go to university. If you get an A star, welcome to my university. What we haven't done, and what we've almost forgotten what it is to do, is teach people maths in a way that means they enjoy maths, they learn maths, they can use maths, and when you test them 15 years later about mathematical problems, they've actually learned something. And this really annoys me. I worry that it's the product of a competitive society which has a Secretary of State for Education who thinks that by testing and examining people more and more and more, she's going to get them better at things, because she's not looking at the data. I feel responsible because she did law at my university. But then the Home Secretary did geography at my university. And the Foreign Minister did PPE at my university. And the Chancellor did history at my university. And the Prime Minister did PPE. And the Chief Whip went to my university. They all went to my university. And it's a very narrow mindset that you get. Things are different in different places. This is the proportion of people who walk and cycle to work, up to 50% in the Netherlands. Tim was telling me earlier, it's very flat in the Netherlands. but it isn't the only reason. It didn't always walk and cycle at that rate. People campaign to get it. In the US, it's 3.5% of people walk and cycle. You can't go and paint your own cycle lanes. You can't design yourself a town plan that means people who work here can live here and hence can walk to work. Different countries have had different approaches to whether they think being individualistic is good or planning is good. Individualism is always good for some things, planning is good for other things. When you don't plan at all, you can get awful messes. When you plan too much, you get Stalinism. I mean, to give you the extreme example in the US, a few years ago, I think only 10 years ago, a mayor in Texas opposed the building of pavements in his town in Texas. And his words were, he opposed the building of pavements because pavements were the beginning of the road to socialism. Now, here's my worry, and you can do apologies to the Americans in the audience, we can do a lot of this with what the Americans say. My worry is that we're very similar to Americans. What do we say that people quietly laugh about in Japan and Germany and France about doing things? Final graph for you. This is the segregation index of voting for the Conservative Party. So people often work out segregation indices for people who are Catholic and Protestant in Northern Ireland and so on, but this is a national one for Conservative voting. And it is very, very interesting. It follows the income inequality curve. What's happening is some parts of the country are becoming more and more conservative. Conservative votes are stacking up in those parts of the country. In other parts of the country, Conservative votes are disappearing. The last incredible rise in 2015 has absolutely nothing to do with Scotland, because the last Conservative voter left Scotland several elections ago. Not that bad. But this is a country that's divided. So I now live in Oxford. Little bit of Oxford I live in is 50% Labour voting. I can walk out 10 miles in any direction and you're talking 60% Conservative voting. It was much more mixed in the past. It has become more polarised, and this makes it hard for us to get on. This is data that ONS released by mistake, and George Monbiot graphed, and then they complained. They complained because it's an underestimate of the wealth. They can't be sure. But there's a lot there. Those are the kind of cartoons people used to produce in the 1970s, when in fact we were actually pretty equal and becoming more equal by wealth. They're upset. And I think it's odd that we don't worry about the level of wealth inequality, which is much bigger. But I think we partly don't worry because we've become more divided. So we think if we're in the better half-off areas of the country, we think, well, we must be okay. Well, in fact, we don't realise that our wealth is only held in some pension schemes and property, where the value of the property is largely based on sentiment. And when we retire and try and sell it, we'll be trying to sell it to a student who only has a student loan to be paid. So how are they going to pay the value that you think your house is worth? I said somebody said landlords, and it's interesting. You can base your future on becoming a landlord, but only about a quarter of you can do that, obviously, because you need tenants, which is about the same proportion as MPs in the Houses of Commons that are landlords. MPs, it's not their fault, they were given housing allowances rather than the wage increase, and they bought houses. So a lot of our MPs are landlords, but not the young ones, because we've changed the regulations. So I have lots of optimism about young MPs, because they're having to live in London without the dodgy housing allowances. And I hope that young MPs of all political parties will begin to work out what's going on because of that, in a way that their older MPs didn't. Michael Meacher, lovely MP, died last week, had 11 flats in London. Blair family now have a portfolio of over 43 properties. You can go on about Cameron's estates and so on. It's age. The older ones have the properties. The younger MPs are much more squeaky clean, partly because they haven't had enough time yet. Trickle-down hasn't worked. Plan A is that we have trickle-down in one country. We invite the super rich of the world in. We hope we can get some money from them. I think it's dangerous and I'm worried about it. I do think we're living in really, really interesting times. I am not pessimistic. I think there's absolutely nothing stable about this at all. But that's good for the young. And I'm not getting young anymore. And why I think we need to begin to address some of these problems is that when things begin to go wrong, people are going to get caught. And it won't just be that young aiming professional who's paid £200,000 too much for a flat that isn't worth it. It'll be people who've just retired, it'll be people who've just split up, it'll be somebody who's divorced. And we need to recognise it's going on now, and beginning to address it, because the earlier you begin to address it, the less bad the final consequences are, and the better chances our children and grandchildren will have in future. Thank you very much.
Where are my roving mic is? Thanks, guys. We've literally off. We're going to allow a few minutes for questions. I'm sure there's plenty of you out there that are desperate to ask Danny some questions. So we're going to try and do the roving mics.
Who has a question? Who would like to ask a question? Front here.
What impact do you think the transatlantic and trans-Pacific trade agreements is going to have on your view of your picture of inequality?
What impact will TTIP have? These agreements to mean that countries are allowed to sell services in other countries and that they can't be stopped. It's worrying a lot of people what might happen. Because suddenly a firm can come into this country and provide a health service, private one, in a way, and sue the government for subsidising the NHS because that's unfair competition with it. That's what TTIP will get us in this country. We don't have a big anti-TTIP lobby in this country. There's a much bigger one in many countries in Europe. It does worry me, but the ridiculous optimist in me thinks, I don't understand why, if you do silly things like this and then find they have bad results, why, when you still have a sovereign parliament, can you not pass a law later to turn it back again? TTIP includes a clause that apparently says that we would have to pay a fine if we did that. But I do wonder what would happen if you said we're not going to pay a fine. And there comes a point, once you ought to remember about the UK, we have an absolutely massive debt. When you have a massive debt, you know, what's another few billion pounds fine put on it? So it's worrying. But I think, and again, I think it's a temporary thing. I think TTIP is the end of this experiment in just let people who can make money make as much as they possibly can, and somehow that'll benefit the rest of us.
So you're hoping it'll tip us over the edge?
I think we're near to tipping over the edge in many, many ways. My answer is I think in Europe, TTIP will be stopped by the people trying to stop it in Europe. Partly selfish vested interests. You know, it's actually going to hurt lots of people doing things fairly inefficiently in Europe, as well as protectors, but it could well be the selfish savers. I'm not against free trade and other things. It's this really nasty exploitation of people for as much as you can possibly get, where you just end up with a tiny group in society making a killing against the vast majority. And we've got to that point now. So,
do you think the weird voting system we have contributes to what has always seemed to me to be very thoughtless politics in this country?
Yeah, it's interesting. Apart from Japan, which is the exception, other countries change their voting systems when they introduce fair ones, almost in line with their degree of equality. So a normal European country will have 8 political parties. If you can't find one out of 8 you like, it's a bit sad. So it's chicken and the egg, because when a country, I think, gets more mature and sees each other, people in it as being human, it allows them to actually have a choice politically. Until recently, we only had 3 parties, 2.5 really. Now we've got more. I mean, UKIP's there, the Greens are there, only 1 MP. The SNP. The SNP is the biggest increase in MPs of a third party since 1918. Biggest third party in 1918, anybody want to guess? Labour, no? Wasn't Labour. Liberals. Sinn Féin. Yeah. And then they got independence. But that's your peasants, but it's for the SNP. So interesting things are happening despite our incredible voting system. We have 2.5 and then 3. The United States only has 2 political parties. Singapore just has 1. Last thing to say about voting, though, is dramatic. May 2015, only 25% of the electorate voted for the Conservative Party. It's never been lower in this country. It's never been lower in any rich country in the history of the world, in democracy. Even in the States, the peasant gets about 27% of the electorate. because half the population don't vote. So it's really, really weird. There is one country that's done better than us. In Colombia, a president got elected in just 18% of the electorate. But the point I've got about, when you've got a government, a majority government, voted in by only 1 in 4 of the people registered to vote, it's not stable. The idea that 2020 is somehow fixed and predictable is ridiculous, given how few people actually voted for the government. Okay, more than for Labour and the others, but that's because there are more others. And many of them voted out of fear and worry because the other options looked even worse. It wasn't a kind of popular upswelling of happiness. People are frightened for the future, and understandably frightened.
We'll do one more, we've only got time for one more. A gentleman there. Sorry, Jess, I'm downhill.
You can explain very well why we can't all be rich. You haven't said anything about why we should be happy.
Yes, I'm very sorry. I had some depressing statistics about mental health and so on, which I decided wasn't going to help me do anything slightly jolly. But we're not good on mental health, we're not good on Prozac. We have worse rates of mental health than all the more equal countries. We have more people clinically diagnosed as depressed. You know, Scotland, 1 in 10 people are popping Prozac a day. It's not good. People appear to be living more stable, quietly happier lives in more equal countries. Their relationships stay together for longer. It is easier. The things that cause us to split up from each other are often economic hardship. The pressure on children is lower because you don't have to drive your child towards that particular job. They can actually choose more what kind of thing they want to do in life, and the implications are not terrible. They can also choose from a wider range of partners because we're not segregating them by income as much. But that's what I really should do is begin to get more stats on happiness. But one thing worth ending on, not everything is bad in an unequal country. It's actually very attractive to people because it's very exciting. So lots of people come to London, lots of people come to New York, lots of people think they're going to make their fortunes here. People don't think they're going to make their fortunes in more equal countries because hardly anybody's got a fortune. They also aren't that poor either. More equal countries have lots to recommend themselves about. Their one disadvantage is they do tend to be a little bit dull. If one of the more equal countries in the world could become a bit more exciting as well, I think we really would be on to a winner. Thank you very much, man.
It's been absolutely fantastic having Danny at Thomas Hardy School today, and you know, what he talks about is, for me, is fascinating and just incredibly interesting and thought-provoking. And I know you've already given him a round of applause, but could you please join me in thanking Professor Danny Dorling.